Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I am incredibly excited to talk with today's guest, Dr. Phil Maffetone. Doc, how are you doing?
I'm great, Rob, and it's really wonderful to talk to you and finally meet you, if only electronically. But I'm excited too.
Well, we were talking briefly before we started rolling here. I have followed your work for a long, long time. Read the High Performance Heart, the Maffetone Method, in fitness and in health. Like I've followed all of your work just for a long time, and I tend to be a little bit on the power side of the athletic spectrum. I know that you've had a lot of notoriety for training endurance athletes, although we were also just talking that folks love to pigeonhole folks, and so now you're only the endurance guy, but clearly you've written a lot of material on a wide-ranging number of topics. Could you give folks just a little bit of your background?
Well, boy, it depends on how far back you want to go. I mean,
electrons are cheap, so you go as far back as you want. Yeah.
Yeah. We experience life and hopefully use those experiences to become a better human being, and that's what I've done. I grew up eating junk food, and unfortunately, it had a bad effect on me, and I didn't realize how significant diet was until I was about 18, and I was standing online in the college cafeteria, and I suddenly looked down at my food, and I said, I can't eat this. This isn't real. And it was a real defining moment for me. From a nutrition standpoint, up until that point, I had run track. I was a track and field athlete in high school and college, and I just didn't like the whole trend from a coaching standpoint, and the whole physical and mental aspect of the sport, and I kind of became a loner in terms of coaching myself, and I had a lot more success that way. And eventually, I decided I wanted to be a doctor and help people, and that's what I did. And got into private practice in 1977, and was always interested in exercise physiology, and that's the type of patient I attracted. And back then, the running boom was beginning to really explode, and most of the people out there were runners, a couple of cyclists and swimmers here and there, and the world of triathlon had just been born out west, and I was in New York. It took a while to get there, but that was exciting too. But I've worked in literally every sport, from motorsports to equine racing, and it's been a really wonderful ride along the way. And of course, as you say, I'm more well known for the endurance sports for whatever reason. But I continued to compete on my own until the early 80s, when it was just too difficult to travel with athletes, get them ready for the race, and then at the last minute, me jump into the race. And the fun came out of it, and so I stopped competing. I haven't competed since then, but I still work out and do many different things, and am enjoying life to the fullest.
Very cool. And Doc, you were really, in my estimation, like a few folks like you, Dr. Fred Hatfield, were just incredibly formative for me in both my athletic pursuits, but also how I tackle things as a strength and conditioning coach. And I think both of you guys were just decades ahead of where everybody else is with their training and kind of their epistemology that they bring to their coaching. How did you arrive at some things like really looking at heart rate training and trying to produce a more fat-fueled athlete? How did you arrive at that stuff so early? I mean, particularly, maybe we'll look at the heart rate training first, and you know, how you arrived at that and what the benefits are of looking at some of the methodology that you've used, and then also trying to build a more fat-fueled athlete. Like, that was really avant-garde stuff when you consider, like, the 70s and 80s and the fat phobia that was occurring then.
Oh, sure. Fats, and fats are still a four-letter word, and I remember, I think it was 84, 85 maybe, that I wrote a manuscript and was able to get it to Norton, and they looked at it and they loved it, and it was called The Big Fat Lie. And it talked about the good side of fats, of natural fats, and how margarine and these trans fats that were being popular are actually harmful, because they knew that in the 50s. This was nothing new. And they said, well, we're going to, you know, we love this manuscript, and we're going to run it by our medical committee just to make sure. Well, that didn't go well. They, you know, I still have the letters that they sent to the, you know, the higher-ups in the publishing company. And they were like, is this guy crazy? We all know that margarine was developed for heart patients. Fats are good. What's he talking about? Everybody knows fats are bad. And it was just a real pathetic response. And things haven't changed too much, but there are some great books out there, like your books, and people are getting it. It's still a hard sell. The heart monitor relationship. There were no heart monitors back when I began. And I used manual pulse taking and realized that that was had a very high error rate. I used some of the new pulse, the finger pulse meters, and I realized that as your heart rate got up, those became inaccurate. And I found a heart monitor that was made for hospitalized cardiac patients who were going to be doing rehab. And that it was like a crossing guard outfit. You kind of put this big strap around your chest, and then one went over your shoulder, and there was a box that slipped into this little netting in the front, and you had to look down your shirt to see the heart rate. And so I developed a reputation when I would go to the track, which I did every week with a group of athletes that I was working with. And, you know, I was the guy who was connected with those people who kept looking down their shirts. and you know, the Polar monitor was the first wireless to come out, and that was not until, I think, 1983. And that was great, because then athletes were able to have their own heart rate monitor. But I was looking for a way for individuals to monitor their workouts, because they would go out and train, and or I would go to the track and I would look at them, and I used a lot of different types of evaluations in the office. I could do physical exams and see the results of some of the problems associated with overtraining. But on the track, I could look at their gait, and you know, humans have been looking at gates for millions of years. You know, animals have been looking at our gates. We've been looking at animal gates, and humans have been looking at other humans to observe their gait and get a good sense of what's going on in the body. And what I found was that at some point in intensity, the gait would become more erratic. And it just, everything clicked. I said, well, we need to monitor the pulse better. And when I eventually found that hospital heart monitor, it really helped. And I had one, and then I bought two. And I had them in my office, and I would put them on the runners when we'd go to the track and evaluate them that way. And eventually came up with a formula that they could use to train themselves. And then the wireless heart monitors came out, and then, you know, that was a great biofeedback tool for people in all sports. I mean, I had weightlifters who were using heart monitors for their warm-ups and cool downs and their off-season periods, where they would build aerobic muscle fiber function, which is well endowed with blood vessels, and those blood vessels bring in nutrients to the neighboring anaerobic muscle fibers, which were not very well endowed, were actually were void of blood vessels. So, there, you know, I had a lot of uses for this, including weight control and, you know, just everything. And it was an interesting time.
Doc, you know, it's interesting because I think you can graft on some of kind of the puritanical work ethic of if I just work harder, then that's the way I'm going to succeed. And then, you know, take some of the modern fitness trends like CrossFit and whatnot, where they consider heart rate merely a correlate of intensity, not the defining feature of intensity. And so, you know, there's been this I think that, you know, the pendulum had maybe 5-6 years ago had swung very, very heavily towards high intensity intervals, almost at the exclusion of any type of aerobic base building. Can you explain to folks why it's important? I mean, you kind of alluded to it a little bit, even for weightlifters, why building this aerobic base is important. Why is it important for the heart? Why is it important for the vasculature? Why is it important for the muscles?
Yeah, you know, I think one problem in terms of how this all began, how this trend started, goes back to the maybe the 60s, even before Dr. Cooper wrote his famous aerobics book. What was going on was there were not a lot of people out there, you know, jogging and running, and, you know, the marathon was just kind of an Olympic event, and people didn't think of doing it themselves. But that started changing in the 60s and into the 70s. And there were a lot of people all of a sudden becoming endurance athletes, and there were not a lot of coaches around. And what happened was many of the coaches from track and field came into endurance sports, and they brought with them their work ethic, which was intervals and faster is better. If you want to race fast, you've got to train fast. And it's a completely different sport, endurance, when you compare it to track and field. Endurance sports requires a high degree of aerobic function, and track and field requires a high degree of anaerobic function. So they're night and day in many ways. And I think all you have to do is look at the physiology and look at the body and look at the, you know, the kinds of muscle we possess versus other animals. You know, if you look at a chicken, they have separate aerobic and anaerobic muscle fibers, and they use their aerobic fibers, which are in their leg muscles, their thigh muscles, that's the dark meat, and they use them to walk around all day, and they can do that and not get fatigued. But when they have to flap their wings, and if they have to try and fly, those are used, you know, those are associated exclusively with their anaerobic muscles, and that activity can't go on for more than literally a few seconds. You know, I have chickens here, and if they fly, they'll take off and fly for literally a few seconds, and then they exhaust their anaerobic muscles, and that's the end. In humans, our muscles, all our muscles except for the jaw muscles, are a mixture of aerobic and anaerobic fibers. And the aerobic fibers are very important for everything, not just for running a marathon or a 10K, but for everything. Certainly in a marathon, we use a lot more of the aerobic fibers because our aerobic energy in a marathon, 99% of it comes from the aerobic system. And, you know, when we talk about these things, it can get confusing. And people often say, you know, this is all very confusing. It is confusing because researchers have made it confusing. They can't agree on definitions. They can't agree on even simple definitions like what, you know, what does the term aerobic mean and what does the term anaerobic mean? You ask the average person and they'll say, well, aerobic is breathing and anaerobic is not breathing, is not oxygen. So I said, well, good. Next time you go out into a race, you don't have to breathe. Just hold your breath and,
right,
you know, see how far you go. So the confusion is prevalent, and a lot of it is on the scientific end. But the aerobic system of the body is what makes us fundamentally great human beings. We're naturally athletic, and whether we are a strength oriented person, because that's what we enjoy doing, or a ultra marathon who strives to run 6-day races or 1,000-mile races, we need a good amount of aerobic function in order to not only perform better but be healthy. The aerobic component of us plays a major role in being healthy.
Doc, how does your approach to fueling then kind of, it seems like it overlaps well with your approach with regards to building an aerobic base and whatnot. So how does the fueling then overlay when we look at, this mixed fiber type and then kind of look at what type of athletic event somebody's doing? How does the fueling then kind of extrapolate from that?
Well, when we look at the aerobic system, we quickly realize that fat becomes the fuel for that system. And if we're going to do anything long-term meaning, more than a half a mile in race performance, for example, then we're going to rely on a significant amount of fat for energy. But it's really about, it's not, do we burn fat or do we burn sugar, or do I want to be a fat burner or do I want to be a sugar burner? We have both. There's a whole spectrum of energy. And if we're on the one side of the spectrum where we're not using a lot of fat, then we're going to be more fatigued. We're going to accumulate body fat. We're not going to have good endurance. And as we move along the spectrum and start burning more fat, then we shed that extra body fat. We become better at being a natural endurance animal. We begin producing more ketones, and if we feel better further down the spectrum, further along the spectrum where we want to burn more fat, well, we start making more ketones, and we can measure that in the urine at some point. But it's a spectrum. It's like going from black to white. There's all these gray areas in between, and we have to decide how much. If we focus on fat, it really makes it easier. We have to decide how much fat we want to burn for energy, and we're not gonna be able to attach a number to it, but we should be able to go by feel. All animals on Earth know how to eat, except for humans.
Right.
And we should know, if I look at my life and charted it out, so to speak, in terms of we can pick anything, but if we pick carbohydrate intake, once I realized that the food on my tray when I was 18 years of age was not real, well, I began eating real food, and that included real carbohydrates. But if I plot my food intake, my carbohydrate intake from that point to today, it's followed a downward trend, and it hasn't done that because I've tried to rationalize, maybe I should be eating this way or that way. It's because I felt the need to eat less carbohydrates. So I've reduced the carbohydrate gradually over the years, and that enabled me to keep a high amount of fat burning going. And that's what people really need to do. They need to be aware of what their body is. We have these brains that are incredible, and our brain is told everything. And sometimes that is interfered with by TV commercials and articles in running magazines that tell us we should be eating a lot of carbohydrates. Well, they're only saying that because their advertisers are carbohydrate advertisers. And so we get all this misinformation. And fat burning is really what being human is all about.
Doc, I it's funny because this is just such a contentious topic in the the paleo sphere, I guess, right now, if we want to call it that. For myself, I had always had all kinds of health problems, GI problems. I was kind of doughy as a teenager, lifted a lot of weights, was reasonably strong, but just wasn't as lean as what I would have liked to be. And then eventually got into this kind of cyclic low-carb way of eating and felt really, really good. One of the challenges that I've faced with in this story is that I've kind of gravitated towards these very glycolytic or glycogen-demanding sports, doing MMA and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, grappling type stuff. And I found that if I was just kind of lifting weights or I was just doing more kind of aerobic activity, I could do pretty well with the more fat-fueled approach, even a ketotic approach. But I found that when I started really mucking around with a lot of glycolytic activity, I just kind of needed more carbs to fuel that. And I've played with that. You know, I now mainly do some post-workout carbs after I've done like a hard Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu session. And then my meals are more some protein, low glycemic load carbs, mainly coming from like cashews and maybe a little bit of squash and whatnot, but I'll do a pretty good whack of carbs post-workout. And then my other, you know, a very low titration of carbs, little higher fat, and then moderate protein. What do you think about that? I mean, it seems like if somebody's on one end of the spectrum, either in that strength athlete deal or the legit long endurance athlete story, it seems like it can more easily be fat fueled. But if you stick somebody in that middle, like a boxer, wrestler, MMA athlete, it seems like it's hard to not largely carbohydrate fuel that person. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, first of all, you have found what works for you, and you've done it in you know, by eating natural foods, not by you know, eating pasta every day because you need the, you know, it's not about that. And I think the strength athletes are way further down on that spectrum, that energy spectrum, than most people realize. They're not all the way to the left, where we're really a carbohydrate-based animal, where we have all kinds of problems. The strength athlete is further down, where they are using some fats, but they're also requiring more carbohydrate, and that's not a problem. I think we can explain this in many different ways, but I think focusing on insulin might be a good way to do it. In your case, for example, you're not producing a lot of insulin because you don't eat meals that trigger insulin, a significant insulin response. And when you do eat some carbs, you're doing it post-workout, for example, where you're still not going to produce insulin if you consume some carbohydrates, some natural carbohydrates, or even a glucose solution within that window right after your workout. And I like to do it within about 15 minutes of the workout. And of course, during the workout, we don't produce insulin. So, you know, someone doing a weight workout, for example, or a boxer, in a session, who needs to keep his energy up. And it's not just his carbohydrate energy, it's his fat burning energy too, because we assist fat burning by having enough carbohydrate. So consuming a drink like a marathoner in the middle of a marathon may need to consume some glucose. That's okay, because we're not producing insulin. We have a huge number of non-insulin dependent receptors in our muscles, and we have this image, and we've all learned this in basic physiology, that the muscle has an insulin dependent receptor, and insulin comes along carrying glucose, and it hooks into this receptor, and it's able to get glucose into the muscle. Well, what they don't tell us is that there's a lot of non-insulin dependent receptors in muscles that we can use just fine, and the best example of that is what I just mentioned: the fact that we consume glucose during a workout or immediately after a workout, and we still get the glucose into the muscle without requiring insulin. And I've had plenty of athletes who could compete at a very high level, winning races, sometimes going 3, 4, 5 hours without consuming any nutrient during the event. That would be the ideal fat burning situation for an endurance athlete. For you, or for someone who's doing more strength oriented work, the amount of carbohydrate you consume has to be adjusted to your individual needs. For many years, when I would do strength work, whether it was natural work outside lifting boulders, which I love to do, or doing weights, which I do when I don't have enough boulders to move. For a long time, I noticed that I needed to consume more carbohydrates in that situation. I would usually rely on fruit or small amounts of honey. And the last few years, I've realized that, and I'm not doing easier workouts necessarily, I'm realizing that I'm not needing to add more carbohydrate back. I noticed it the other day. I said, boy, this is interesting. I'm not needing to add carbohydrate like I normally would do at this time of year in particular. So it really depends on the individual, and finding out your individual needs is best done by you. And people, you know, people, when they do their workouts, they're trying to do everything but pay attention to their body. They've got an iPod in their ear and they're listening to music, or they're blasting, you know, they're listening to the music that's blasting in a gym. They're talking to other people. You know, you need to not listen to music. You need to listen to your body.
That just sounds like crazy talk, that you would have to customize this stuff based off your individual needs, and that you need to do some self-monitoring to be able to figure that out.
It's insanity. How could he say such a thing? You know, we should all follow the same diet and the same work. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I'm a probably 80% of my time that I spend, like, I'm always in this back and forth story of trying to throw out like a Pareto's 80-20 approach that will help a lot of people. But then the reality is that, you know, a lot of this stuff will apply to most folks. You know, eat whole unprocessed foods, probably avoid some gluten, sleep longer and stuff like that. But then there's this real need for customization and figuring out, well, who are you and what do you want to do? And then we start tweaking and fiddling the formula to fit that. And it's a difficult deal to both send out a general message so that the masses are kind of moving forward. Like I mentioned to you that I did a gig for the Reno Police Department yesterday. And so how do I get these overweight, insulin-resistant cops moving in a more favorable direction? But then within that group of cops, there's always, out of a group of 100 of them, there's 5 or 10 people that are super fit, really watch their food, you know, and then they're kind of like, well, I want to do XYZ. And so I have a completely different message for those folks than I do for the insulin resistant people that are, you know, potentially going to have a heart attack or die young. So it's a juggling act for me. How do you deal with that between like the general message versus the auger in and get the specific message out?
Well, I think when I was in practice, I had to deal with that same question. You know, how do I do this? And it came down to when working one-on-one with somebody that, okay, here are some general guidelines, and these are guidelines that everybody should follow because we're all humans and we have some basic needs that apply to virtually all of us. And then there are these individual things, and I'm going to explain these individual things to you because I've evaluated you and I've come up with things, and you've inadvertently told me a lot of the things that are going to help you. And by the way, what I want to really do is help you help yourself, because you need to understand how to change your diet, because your human body is changing all the time. And from today to next month or next year, there may be changes. The seasons change, our physical activity, our mental activity changes. We go through different phases of life and our needs will change slightly, not dramatically. But it's, you know, there are plenty of very significant I don't want to call them rules, but there are things that humans should never do. One of them is to eat junk food. And why we can't get that, I mean, you and I have been trying to get this message across for a long time, and why it's so difficult, I don't know, other than to say that, A, people are addicted to sugar and they can't get off it, and two, they don't want to make a change. So the first thing, it took me a few years to figure this out. Patients would come in and I would work really hard to convince them that they need to be healthy. And I finally realized that, well, I'm going to ask them that question in the very beginning. And so I started, I'd walk into a room and I would say, are you willing to do what you need to do to get healthy? And some of them actually said no. And for the first time in several years, I started dismissing patients. I said, well, you and I are not a good match. I can't work with you. I'll give you some of the names of doctors I refer to, and you can go see one of those doctors. And so the first question people need to ask themselves is, am I willing to make the changes that I need to make with my diet and everything else in life in order to not have all these gut problems, all these, my memory is fading, my endurance is fading, I wake up in the middle of the night, I don't have as much energy, I don't have, my sexual performance is diminishing, I don't want to go there, how can I change it? And so there are some basic, really fundamental things that humans should not do, and eating junk food is one of them, and it's probably the most difficult thing for most people.
Yeah, I've been working on a blog post a little bit around that line, where looking at hyperpalatable and just very novel food, something that stimulates these dopaminergic centers of the brain. It's like hookers and cocaine. It's like, would you pass up hookers and cocaine? Probably not. And that to some degree, hopefully, if folks can wrap their head around this idea that, this is a signal that is so far above what we are kind of evolutionarily evolved to experience, that it makes damn good sense that you don't eat one Pringle, that you eat the whole can, and if you could wrap your head around the fact that it's not necessarily sloth, not necessarily gluttony, that there's some good wiring that goes into that, but now we need to make a decision. Are we going to do something about that or not? It's like you can quit beating up your inner child for it, because this is actually some great engineering that would make you eat that whole quart of ice cream or whatever. But now that we recognize that, then okay, do we want to continue doing that? Yes or no? And then it's a hell of a process to get people moving away from that, because again, I think we're fighting some evolutionarily conserved machinery where we would eat everything that we could get our paws on at a given moment, because the next day might be a little on the skinny side.
Sure, and I've seen it in nature. When you have a beehive to help pollinate your food, but the bears attack it every fall, or try to. I could see humans doing that. They're wandering through the woods and they see a beehive, and it's late in the year and the hive is full of honey. Well, man, I remember tasting that honey one time, and I'm going to get it no matter how much I'm stung. And when I get there, I'm going to eat it all. In the bear's case, he or she is ready to hibernate. And the more fat he can store, the better his hibernation is going to be. And humans have that that physiological relationship too. And but there's still the issue of, do I want to do what is necessary to feel better? And in attempting to deal with this issue, back beginning in the late 70s into the, by the early 80s, I had this thing called the 2-week test. And my goal was to let somebody feel what it's like to have a low insulin level, to not have these high insulin peaks and these low blood sugar reactions and impair fat burning and on and on and on. I said, you know, 2 weeks should be enough to begin the process so most people can notice a change. And so let's call out the 2 week test. And for a period of 2 weeks, they would not eat any junk food or any moderate glycemic index foods like beans and
sweet potatoes and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Sweet
yeah,
sweet potatoes. And it was interesting because at the end of 2 weeks, many people said this is the, you know, we're talking about like a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old or even a 30-year-old. They'd say, wow, this is the best I've ever felt in my life. And I'd say, well, okay, you're on the way. And now you need to put back some of those natural carbohydrates, you know, add a piece of fruit to your breakfast or whatever, and see if you start feeling not quite as wonderful as you do right now. And what I found was happening was that some people got it and they were able to move on and progress and they did very well. But many, many people could not do it. They would do the two-week test. They'd feel incredibly wonderful. New people, miracle, this is a miracle. You're a miracle doctor. No, I'm not a miracle doctor. You have a miracle body and that's what you're feeling. And then I'd see him a month or two later and they'd say, yeah, well, I did that for a while, but then my kids came home with some candy and I couldn't say no and I went to a party and, you know. And so then I did the two-week test again. And then they started calling it the two-week diet. I said, no. It's not a diet. It's a test. But it all comes down to the bottom line. Do you want to do what is necessary to make you have a high quality of life? We're not going to change our lifespan significantly. The question is, do you want to live a full life until the moment you die? And it's as simple as that.
It's interesting. I just share such parallel philosophy as you do, having had very parallel experiences too. You know, clients that would come into the gym and would profess a possibly their life had been saved by doing this stuff, and then 6 months, maybe a year later, you haven't seen the person in the gym for a while. You run across them at one of the, you know, some social event in town, and they've gained a bunch of weight back and they're clearly chagrined about the situation. And I've just been ill prepared at how to help those folks further, because I've historically been busy enough that I've had in queue a number of folks that really, really wanted some help. And like we've had some pretty good success in the autoimmune scene. And so these people are potentially going to die, you know, and so if I can help them, then that literally is maybe helping to save someone's life. So I've been very, very reticent to burn a lot of time on folks that didn't want to help themselves. Like I have a lot of empathy and sympathy for them, because I think I understand on a pretty good level why these hyper palatable foods and this kind of wacky lifestyle that we have, staying up late, not sleeping enough, you know, reticence to exercise at times. Like I understand all that, but once that person has kind of had their eyes opened and they understand it too, but make a decision to do something different, then it's kind of like, well, no harm, no foul, but I've got a lot of work to do and these folks are actually going to do what I ask them to do. So
yeah,
I'm going to go do that. Yeah.
And that's the key, is that, you know, I don't have time to play games with you, because I've got a waiting list of patients who want help. And so goodbye. It's a tough call. And you know, when you're out there and you run into that person you haven't seen for a year and they've gained a bunch of weight and they're hobbling along, you know, what do you do? What do you say? It's a very delicate situation, and invariably we start having a name attached to us that is a really bad name, and it's, you know, people look at us and they think, well, we're judgmental. And it's a, you know, and that makes things worse. You know, I'm not judgmental when I'm saying just stop eating junk food. I know what it's like. I've gone through it. I know what sugar addiction is and how painful it is, and I know what, you know, eating a cookie and not being able to stop until the whole bag is gone. It's that whole addiction thing. And by the way, what I found out with addiction is that there's a whole within that whole addictive world is a whole hierarchy of more primary addictions and more secondary addictions. And I've worked with a lot of people who have tried to get off and successfully have gotten off everything from alcohol to heroin to cigarettes. And what I found was that the sugar addiction is a primary problem. And if you can get them off sugar first, everything else goes a lot easier. And of course, in our society, if you go to an AA meeting, what do you see? They're sugar. Just, you know, they're eating a lot of sugar and drinking a lot of coffee and smoking a lot of cigarettes. That's treating symptoms, and that's really the foundation of our whole healthcare system. So, but I know what it's like, and I've been through it, and I'm not being judgmental in any way. And it's a tough call when you're in that situation.
Yeah, you have a lot of love for the folks, but you've got to kind of triage and decide, are you going to
exactly sort
of keep throwing energy into what is unlikely to be a favorable outcome, or, you know, the next person in line may be ready to go and, you know, save their life and make your life worth living doing it. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Doc, did we miss anything? I wanted to ask you a little bit about the barefoot running and your gait analysis and whatnot. Again, you were just really at the bleeding edge of that whole concept. Like, you know, before the barefoot running, minimalist running became a popular topic, you were, you know, encouraging your athletes to train at least part of the time barefoot for their events. Like, how did that get on your radar?
I think when I was studying exercise physiology in the mid-70s, still as a student, I read a journal article on EMG where they were measuring the electrical activity of muscles, and they showed that when the subjects had shoes on, the muscle function was not as good as when they didn't have shoes on. And this was in the 50s. And I never forgot that. And even still as a student, when I would start looking at athletes, I wanted to see the pure athlete. I didn't want to observe them on a treadmill. I wanted to observe them outside. And it was great observing them on the road or on a trail, but I wanted to have a flat, smooth surface. So that's when I started going to tracks to look at athletes. And when I got into practice, I just wanted to see the pure human body. And I didn't have them take off their clothes, but obviously the shoes had a significant influence on their posture and their gait. And so taking off their shoes was a way to observe them in as pure a sense as we can observe them. And so the difference from wearing and back in the late 70s, the shoes were so they were just flat. There wasn't a lot to them. When I ran the New York City Marathon in 1980, I wore a training shoe because it was very, very flat. But that was sort of the end of that era of shoemaking, and manufacturers then started making them thicker and thicker. But what I noticed by taking off the shoes of a runner and observing them, that their gaits were night and day. Their gaits were so pure and so balanced when they were without shoes. So then what we had to do was assuming they wanted to keep wearing a shoe, which most did, we had to find a way to balance their body as best we could, then put on a shoe that interfered the least amount. And it was a tedious process, but it was a very effective way of getting what we needed. But you know, people say, well, I don't understand how I should be running. I don't understand how I should be moving in my sport. And if you're making contact with the ground, you better look at your feet and what's going on with your feet, because that's a very important component of the rest of your body's mechanics. And if you take off your shoes, things work a whole lot different. Unless you're a person who has abused their feet for your entire life, and now you're addicted to your shoes. And if you take your shoes off and you're addicted to your shoes, now your feet collapse, they don't work well, and neither does the rest of your body. So that's how I originally got into it, and I realized that many athletes, because they wore shoes all the time, that even at home, that the muscles of their feet were much weaker. In evaluating a lot of the individual muscles of the foot, it was very clear about who, you know, which athletes had the worst shoes based on the muscle function of their feet. And so it was an easy leap to, okay, we need to rehab your feet. How can we do that? Well, just walking around barefoot will eventually correct a lot of those problems. And that's how that all began.
And clearly the spot for folks to start with is just walking. Like, I think that we've seen some pushback on the unshod or minimalist running kind of approach, but it seems like folks are going from, you know, wearing a highly supportive, very shock-absorbing shoe, and then they ditch their shoe, put on a pair of, like, Vibram Five Fingers, and then they try to run the same mileage immediately with no adaptation period, no ramp-up time. I mean, is that how you would generally take somebody that's possibly a little on the broken side, is just get them to walk initially and then ramp
sure.
up from there?
Yeah, it's got to be done very carefully, because imagine you're an inactive executive sitting at a desk all day. You come home and you sit on your couch all day, and the only time you get up is to walk over to the dining room table or go to the bathroom or go to the bed. And you decide, well, I'm going to run a marathon, and you go out and start running 5 miles, or you try to, you know, you're going to crash and burn after the first day. So it's the same thing with the feet. You've got to, you know, you've transitioned into a bad situation from a biomechanical standpoint, and transitioning out of that isn't going to take as long, but it could take a while. There was a recent study that compared the thicker shoes with the Vibram Five Fingers, which is a good shoe, but it's flat. And what they did was they looked to see what the running economy was like, and they compared the running economy initially to the thick shoes versus the Vibrams, and they didn't see any difference in running economy. But they then allowed the runners to wean into the Five Fingers and get used to them, and it took about a month. And after a month, the running economy in the Vibrams was significantly better. And the same thing happens with barefoot running. You're going to take a certain amount of time to adapt, and that adaptation is mostly because the muscles are weak, literally weak from a power standpoint, because you've weakened them by wearing shoes for so long. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take you a little while to get a certain amount of strength and balance, two separate things, back into those muscles. And how long that takes depends on how bad your feet are. But it could take a few weeks easily.
Okay. Doc, it's been fantastic having you on the podcast. Folks can track you down at philmathetone.com. Do you have any other new projects coming out soon, or where can folks track you down besides the website?
Well, that's the best place. I used to write for various magazines, and it wasn't fun. There were too many editorial issues, and now I write things that I think of, whether a lot of people are going to find it interesting or not, and I post it on my website, and there's some misspelling there and maybe some bad punctuation, which were my two worst subjects. But you know, that's really where I am in the world right now, on philmathetone.com.
Fantastic. Well, Doc, again, I've been a huge fan of your work. You've been incredibly influential towards me in my development as a coach, and it's just been a huge honor having you on the show.
Rob, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to be here, and keep up with all the great work you're doing.
I will do my best. You and I definitely have job security in the things that we're trying to promulgate. That's for sure.
We do.
Awesome, Doc. Well, take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Rob.
Okay, bye-bye.